have a secret.
Uh-huh.
I use Secret Whole Body Deodorant because more than just my armpits stink.
Oh, can I use it where my bra rubs under my...
Oh, yeah.
And what about down there? You know, my...
Totally. 4 out of 5 gynecologists would recommend it. So I tried it, and now I get 72 hours of freshness. From my pits to my...
Ooh, I love that it's a spray.
Me too. And it comes in sticks and creams too. Go get your Secret Whole Body Deodorant.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hi. I'm Wendy Zuckerman, and you're listening to Science Versus from Gimlet Media. Our show is normally about what science knows and what it's gotten right. But today, we're looking at a time when scientists, they got it wrong. Really wrong. And there were terrible consequences. It was a time when one of the worst ideas in science got this big push from a bad study. And intellectuals of the day lapped it up. And it all starts here, more than 100 years ago.
They should put a plaque up here. Here lies bad science.
I think we'll just walk around the perimeter, right? Like, I don't know if today is the day to get arrested.
Well, let's see, right?
I mean, maybe today is the day.
Senior producer Caitlin Sori and I are at what's left of this old boarding school in New Jersey. It's called the Vineland Training School.
Let's get closer. That looks like the dormitory for all the kids. Oh, it's so creepy looking. Oh, there's a no trespass sign. Inside, on graffitied on the wall, it says forever trapped in red paint.
And our story begins when a little girl called Emma Wolverton was dropped off here in the late 1890s. She was only 8 years old.
Look how imposing this school is. Like, when you approach it from the front, can you imagine being 8 years old and being dropped off here? You'd be like, what is this place?
That little girl, Emma, would grow up at this school and become the centre of what's now a scientific scandal. Science writer Carl Zimmer has written about it in his book, She Has Her Mother's Laugh, and he's helping us tell this story.
And the more you think about it, the more elusive it gets.
Carl told us that Emma's life before being dropped off at this school was pretty chaotic. She was really poor and her mum struggled to keep a job.
She lived in a very difficult environment. Her mother drank a lot and had a series of lovers and was sort of basically moving around from house to house in a very unstable way.
And then Emma's mum found a new boyfriend.
He agreed to marry her, the evidence suggests, if she just got rid of her other children somehow.
So Emma's mum decided to go ahead and palm off her 8-year-old daughter. She brought Emma to the Vineland Training School. It was a school for special needs kids. And it's not clear why Emma's mum chose this school. Emma wasn't severely disabled. But still, at the time, Vineland was kind of cutting edge.
It was actually, you know, for its time, a very humane place in some ways. I mean, these children were not warehoused. They were kept in clean cottages and got a lot of fresh air. And, you know, the patrons built a zoo on the grounds.
A zoo?
And so on.
What kind of animals did they get?
Oh, they got, you know, nothing too exotic. Maybe some pheasants and maybe a wolf or something like that. There are no rhinoceroses or anything.
Oh,
but still, you know, it was nice.
As Emma grew up in this school, she acted in plays, learned this instrument called the cornet, and did woodworking. And life was humming along until she was 17, when Emma met a man named Henry Goddard, who came to work at the school. And this man, Henry, would go on to make her world famous.
Can you tell us about him? Like, what did he look like?
So Henry Goddard was a fairly short, bespectacled man, and he was a psychologist. And he was actually one of the first child psychologists in the United States.
And Henry is the scientist at the center of this story. You see, he came to Emma's school because he had a very particular research interest, intelligence, why some people are smarter than others. And Henry thought that this special school at Vineland was the perfect place to study intelligence because the kids here were thought of as feeble-minded. That was the medical terminology of the day. And it included kids that one might politely refer to as dim.
He felt as if there was almost like a laboratory because these feeble-minded children were not developing as ordinary children were. And he was thinking that if he could just understand these more slowly developing children, that he would discover some of the fundamental rules for how all children learn.
So Henry tries to figure out what made these feeble-minded kids so dim. And his first step was to measure just how feeble-minded they were.
He wanted to measure their intelligence with a number, in the same way you'd measure someone's height with a tape measure.
So Henry uses this test, one of the first IQ tests, on Emma and the other kids. And in it, there are questions like, count backwards from 20, or use the words money, river, and Philadelphia in a sentence.
You know, I have 5 cents in one pocket, and I have 5 cents in the other pocket. How much money do I have? You know, just questions like that.
And then he would categorize the children by intelligence, using a scale. So, at the bottom, there was the least intelligent. They were called the idiots. Further up were imbeciles. And finally, a category that Henry had invented himself, morons.
You had children who were below average, but were not quite as bad as the children, not quite as low scoring as the children who were called idiots or imbeciles.
In Henry's mind, imbeciles and idiots were obviously stupid, but morons, although they were a bit dumb, could still pass as normal. And we know, by today's standards, this is straight up offensive. But 100 years ago, this was science. So, guess who Henry put in that category of moron?
So Emma was a moron, according to Henry's judgment.
Yes, the little girl abandoned at Vineland as a child. She was a moron. Now that he had neatly categorized the children and Emma into a taxonomy of idiocy, he had to figure out the question of why. Why were they so stupid?
So Henry discovers this newfangled kind of science in the early 1900s, genetics. And suddenly, the way he understands it, this answers everything.
Genetics. Scientists at the time had this really basic understanding of what genes were. So they knew that traits were passed down through the generations, like how tall you were. And they were starting to suspect that other things were linked through genes as well.
Why would it be that, you know, a father who was a horse thief would have a son who, you know, had trouble learning how to count? Or, you know, like somehow they were sure that these things were connected under the name feeble-mindedness, but they had no explanation why.
This was Henry's theory. There was a gene for feeble-mindedness that was carried on from one generation to the next. And he decides that he's going to use the kids at Vineland to make his case.
He figured, I just need to go out and do some research, and I can prove to you that feeble-mindedness is just genetic, and that you just inherit it the way you might inherit your eye color.
Henry ends up zeroing in on Emma as the key to his theory. So one of his assistants had started tracking down Emma's family to see how many morons were in her family tree. And then this assistant comes back with some very exciting news.
Emma Wolverton's family is actually one big giant experiment.
Here's what the assistant found. There's this big split in Emma's family tree, which all started when one man had children with two different women. And that man who started this whole thing was Emma's great-great-great-granddad. And he was a revolutionary soldier.
Joins a militia, and they stay one night in a tavern. He gets drunk, has sex with a tavern wench, and then goes off on his merry way.
And that tavern wench, she was feeble-minded, and she gets pregnant with a kid who grew up to be known as Old Horror.
You got to be really bad news to get a nickname like Old Horror. So Old Horror, among other things, liked to get drunk, and people would buy him drinks if he would go vote for whoever the candidate was. And he was very happy to vote early and vote often.
In fact, the tavern wench didn't just spawn one degenerate.
Her descendants were feeble-minded as well.
She spawned a dynasty of morons. There were horse thieves, brothel keepers, criminals, all in all, more than 100 degenerates, going all the way down to Emma Wolverton. But that wasn't the end of the story here. Because, you see, there was another branch of the family tree. After the revolutionary soldier left the tavern wench behind, he then went on to marry another woman. The right kind of woman.
He goes off and has a very, you know, upstanding life. He marries a woman of good Quaker stock, the way it's described. And then they have lots of kids who have kids of their own. And they're all upstanding citizens and prominent people of prominence and so on and so forth.
On the good side of the family, there were all kinds of successful people, doctors, lawyers, judges. And they married into the best families in their state, including a family where someone signed the Declaration of Independence.
So to Henry Goddard, this is proof positive that he was right, that feeble-mindedness is totally genetic. And if you just happen to inherit this feeble-mindedness gene, then forget it. You're done for. And that Emma Wolverton was just the latest in a long line of feeble-minded people.
Henry realized that his findings were groundbreaking. Feeble-mindedness really was passed down from generation to generation. And all these morons were having babies.
It was just going to keep going up and up and up. And something had to be done to stop the rising tide of feeble-mindedness, or the whole country was done for.
Henry now had this sense of urgency, that no one could see how big this problem was becoming.
And he needs a way to get the word out quickly. And so what he decides to do is to make Emma Wolverton his iconic example. He's going to tell her story and publish a book.
In 1912, Henry publishes a book about Emma's family. And it was a book not just for scientists, but for the lay public too. And to protect Emma's identity, always a sensitive guy, Henry changes her name to Deborah Kallikak. Kallikak being a mixture of two Greek words, meaning beautiful and bad.
So you had this family where you had the good on one side and the bad on the other.
Ooh.
The book is called The Kallikak Family, and it went viral. Well, you know, viral for 1912.
You know, somebody tries to make a Broadway show out of it. I mean, it really, it totally penetrates popular culture and also high culture.
One of the reasons the Kallikak story went viral was that it really hit on a nerve. You see, in the beginning of the 20th century, America was really coming into its own. It was the promise of a great new nation. Cities were industrializing, businessmen like Henry Ford were reshaping America. And as many American intellectuals and Henry Goddard saw it, this dream was being dragged down by the feeble-minded.
for someone like Henry Goddard, it was a very disturbing time in places like New Jersey and Pennsylvania and New York, a real turbulent kind of change happening. You had white families who had been there since colonial times shifting from farms into the cities. And as they were going there trying to get work in the factories, there was a huge amount of poverty that they were suffering from.
On top of this, there were these waves of immigration, new people coming from Asia and Eastern Europe that many Americans were worried about. Ultimately, there was a fear that there were too many losers and bad hombres getting into America.
Waves of immigration that were starting to come, not just from England, but from other countries like Italy or Russia and so on. And I can't tell you how many people felt that there was this rising tide of feeble-mindedness in the country that had to be controlled if the country itself was going to survive.
In Henry's book, The Kallikak Family, he wrote, quote, "There are Kallikak families all about us. They are multiplying at twice the rate of the general population. And not until we recognize this fact and work on this basis will we begin to solve these social problems." End quote.
How is it a bestseller? It sounds like a bit of a dud read.
This is an explanation for, my own prejudices. And it's science.
And it's science, right.
Something had to be done to stop this bloated class of morons from breeding. But what? Perhaps the morons and the imbeciles shouldn't be allowed to have children. Yeah, we're talking about eugenics, selectively breeding the human race. And the idea of eugenics had been bubbling along for years before the Kallikak story was published. In fact, Charles Darwin's half-cousin came up with eugenics about 30 years before. But by 1912, it had become really popular, and many highly respected intellectuals, men of science, were mad for it.
All of the leading universities had very prominent, outspoken eugenicists among their ranks. Presidents of universities like David Jordan, president of Stanford University, ardent eugenicist. Henry Osborne, president of the American Museum of Natural History, full-out eugenicist. So you can't say that this was some odd little perverse idea that just a few people had. This was mainstream.
When you go through the list of notable eugenicists, it reads like a who's who of the early 1900s. Like, there's Alexander Graham Bell, the guy who painted the first telephone, Margaret Sanger, who led the fight for birth control, she was a eugenicist, and even Helen Keller, who was blind and deaf, she was a eugenicist. And all this popular support to stop the morons from breeding, it wasn't just talk amongst highfalutin intellectuals. It led to real laws, where so-called morons were actually sterilized by the state. And that meant for men, vasectomies, and for women, tying or cutting fallopian tubes. And while some of these laws kicked in before the Kallikak family was published, after the book came out, more and more states started passing laws to make sure that some morons couldn't have babies.
So this book was actually extremely influential. And Henry Goddard himself actually lobbied state governments to put sterilization laws on the books.
And when some questioned what was happening in the highest court, the Kallikak story showed up there too. In the 1920s, a case challenging these sterilization laws went all the way to the Supreme Court. The case focused on an 18-year-old woman from Virginia called Carrie Buck. And after she had a baby out of wedlock, she was deemed feeble-minded and sexually promiscuous. And the state wanted to sterilize her.
The state of Virginia, defending sterilization, actually presented the Kallikak family the book as part of their evidence to the Supreme Court.
Carrie lost the case. The judge wrote, "It is better for all the world if society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind." Carrie's mother and baby were also considered feeble-minded. And so the judge finished up by saying, quote, "Three generations of imbeciles are enough."
And the Supreme Court said, yeah, go ahead, go off and sterilize.
So, Carrie was sterilized. And as a result of this judgment, now states could just keep sterilizing their so-called feeble-minded men and women. So while Henry's book was being brandished by politicians and lawyers and used to justify sterilizing America's poor and unwell, the story of the Kallikak family had become world famous. And it even makes its way across the Atlantic, where, by the 1930s, an up-and-coming populist gets his hands on it. Adolf Hitler.
Ist die amerikanische Familie Kallikak, die Nachkommen des Leutnants Kallikak.
This was a Nazi propaganda film, Das Erbe, or The Inheritance, and it was broadcast just after the Nazis got into power. In the film, we can see a man in a lab coat showing us all the branches of the Kallikak family tree, from the tavern wench all the way down to Emma.
Kallikak hatte aber noch ein voreheliches Kind mit einer geistesschwachen Frau.
We know that the Kallikak family became a iconic example of why the Nazis wanted to control reproduction, how they wanted to improve the master race through all sorts of increasingly horrific ways.
Back in America, the Kallikak family was also used to pass immigration laws that ended up making it harder for Jewish people fleeing the Nazis to reach America. After the Nazi eugenics program and the horrors of World War II became common knowledge, eugenicists in the US were shoved to the fringes. And even before then, as scientists realized that intelligence was more complicated than a feeble-minded gene, eugenics had started to fall out of favor within the scientific community.
You know, you have eugenics sort of disappearing from the names of societies, disappearing from the names of journals.
And Henry, after he wrote this hugely influential book supporting these now taboo ideas, what became of him? Well, he also stepped away from eugenics, but he always defended his great study of the Kallikak family.
He keeps insisting, no, this was good, solid psychology, science, good genetics, this is important stuff. But then after World War II, he was very old by that point, just, you know, quieted down and then died in relative obscurity. You know, his obituaries basically note, this is the guy who came up with the word moron.
But there's one final twist to this Kallikak story, a mystery that took 70 years to solve. That's coming up after the break.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back. So we've heard the story of the Kallikak family, how one bad apple, one feeble-minded wench rotted the entire family tree, spawning generations of morons and freaking out America. The story supported sterilization laws and then spread across the Atlantic into Nazi Germany, before society agrees that eugenics is a bad idea. But the Kallikak story didn't completely fade away. In the mid-1960s, a college kid called David Smith heard about it at his school.
I was taught about the Kallikak family in college. It was sort of the prime example of heredity being destiny, and it just stuck with me.
Why was that?
Because it just sounded a little bit shaky.
David started thinking that this story was just a bit too tidy. Could one wench really spawn all these morons? Could genes be solely responsible for tainting generations of people? It just didn't make sense to him.
That's exactly right. It didn't make sense to me. And I was driven, I might say driven, to see what I could find out about it.
And part of the reason why David didn't quite believe this theory about your genes being the one thing that made you smart and successful or not was because he looked at his own life and he knew things were more complicated than that.
I came from a family who had no opportunity for education. My mother was a housewife. My father was a machinist at a railroad company. And sometimes I felt all I could hope to do was work for the railroad like my father had.
David saw his family in the Kallikaks, and it felt personal. David ultimately became an academic. He's now an emeritus professor at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro. And back in the 1980s, he wanted to know more about this Kallikak family. The first step was uncovering who Deborah Kallikak actually was, because back then, her true identity wasn't public knowledge. So David went to where it all started, to Vineland in New Jersey, to see what he could find.
I went to the institution where she had been institutionalized and didn't get any leads there. But then as I left that town, I stopped into a little diner, and the people at the table next to me saw that I had Virginia tags on my car, and they wanted to know why was I in Vineland, New Jersey. I told them and what I needed to know, and they said, well, we know her. We've been volunteers at the institution for years. And they gave me her real name, and my journey began unraveling the story.
By the time he knew that Deborah Kallikak was actually Emma, she'd already died. But David's detective work was just beginning.
Once I had the name, then I could go to courthouses and historical societies.
David ended up tracking down a lot of Emma's relatives.
And I found that the story of the Kallikaks was a myth.
A myth. In fact, it was complete nonsense.
Some of the so-called good Kallikaks were not so good, and all of the bad Kallikaks were not so bad.
There were lots of people with respectable jobs on the bad side of Emma's family. Bank treasurers, policemen, and school teachers. And, like, take for example that guy, Old Horror, the illegitimate child of the revolutionary soldier and the tavern wench. Well, David worked out that he owned property, and according to the census of 1850, his whole family could read, which was a pretty good lot for back then.
He was not a horror. It was not so much Old Horror as the horror that was placed on this family.
Not only did Henry call people feeble-minded when there wasn't the evidence for it, but he just totally messed up the family tree. Like, Old Horror, he wasn't even the revolutionary soldier's kid. He was his second cousin.
That's right. I think it is pretty incredible, but it's true.
So, the so-called science that people were using to justify these sterilization and anti-immigration laws, it was garbage to begin with. And we now know that intelligence doesn't just flow through our genes. Yes, having smart parents helps. But scientists have come to realize that our environment, like where we go to school, does play an important role too. And what happened to Emma, a.k.a. Deborah Kallikak? Well, when Emma was in her mid-20s, she got too old for the Vineland Training School, so they sent her to another facility across the road for feeble-minded women. And she stayed there for the rest of her life.
Do we know, was she feeble-minded?
No, she wasn't.
Well, feeble-minded as a label is pretty meaningless to begin with. But still, when we look at school records, it said that Emma, while she struggled with reading and numbers, she was good at other things, like carpentry and taking care of kids. And sometimes she'd even be put in charge of kindergarten classes.
But the more I looked into it, I saw that she had been needlessly institutionalized for most of her life.
Emma never saw Henry again after she grew up. From what we can tell, she didn't seem to have any hard feelings, though. She named one of her cats after him. And Henry sent her a Christmas card where he wrote to her his theories of intelligence. And it seems Emma appreciated that he could share such complicated ideas with her. She told a staff member, quote, "The nicest thing about it is that he thought I have the brains to understand it, which of course I do," end quote.
Poor Emma, huh? She was caught in a trap of ideas at the time and had no chance of getting out.
Emma died at the age of 89, and she was buried on the institution grounds. The story of the Kallikaks is like this fable of how even the smartest people of the day, the scientists, the intellectuals, can get swept up by their own fears and prejudices. This study fed into people's worst instincts, and it gave them evidence and science to back up what they wanted to hear. And so many people just went along for the ride. And it's easy to sit back now and think, well, if this happened today, I wouldn't have fallen for this. I wouldn't have bought into these ideas. But I wonder, if we were making science verses in 1912, would we have shut down the story of the Kallikaks? Would we have seen this for what it was? I don't know. Nah, of course we would have gotten it right. That's Science Versus. This episode was produced by our senior producer, Caitlin Sori, me, Wendy Zuckerman, and Ramila Karnik, with help from Meryl Horn, Rose Rimler, and Shruti Ravindran. We're edited by Blythe Terrell, extra editing help from Alex Bloomberg and PJ Vogt. And extra thanks to Phoebe Flanagan, Peter Vischer, as well as Emily Albright for help with German translations. Fact-checking by Michelle Harris, mix and sound design by Emma Munger, music written by Bobby Lord and Emma Munger. And a huge thanks to all the Zuckerman family and Joseph Lavelle Wilson. Plus, you should check out Carl Zimmer's new book, She Has Her Mother's Laugh. It's all about genetics and heredity, and it's really, really fascinating. I first heard about the story of the Kallikaks in this book, and it totally blew my mind. Next week, we're tackling circumcision. Should you have your baby's foreskin cut off?
It wasn't like the kids were going to say, "Oh, wow, now you're a really cool guy, because now you look like your penis looks like my penis. Come over to my house and we'll play football," you know?
I'm Wendy Zuckerman. Back to you next time.